We are considering a pilgrimage. We have started on our pilgrimage last time and given you kind of a brief, rather hasty summary of what's involved in a pilgrimage. But I want to look at different aspects of it now. The one today is the pilgrimage of the patriarchs. The text is Genesis chapter 47. I want us to begin by looking at three verses in this text. We're going to go elsewhere and look at some other things for a while, and then we're going to come back to this. In Genesis 47, Joseph brings his elderly father Jacob before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh, the head of one of the most powerful empires in the history of the world, looks at this old man, and he recognizes in him power. And there's almost a kind of hushed reverence in the words that are uttered here. Genesis 47:7. Joseph brought in Jacob, his father, and set him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto Jacob, "How old art thou?" And Jacob said unto Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." Now, a curious statement to make, but it's very evident that he set a great store by that idea of pilgrimage. He was a pilgrim. His fathers were pilgrims, and they were very determined in their attitudes about that. Now, what can we learn about our pilgrimage from the lives of such men? I think we can learn a lot, because these things are written not to just give us some insight into ancient history. They are there for spiritual counsel for ourselves. We need the example of these men. These accounts speak to our hearts and tell us something about their relationship with God that we need to know about in our relationships with God. Now, we're going to come back to Genesis 47, but in the meantime, I want to start with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. Abraham was a pilgrim before Jacob. He is the one who started out this odyssey of pilgrimage in the Old Testament. Abraham, the friend of God. And in chapter 12, the Lord said to Abram, "Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and unto thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed." Now here, the Lord singles out Abraham. He's called Abram here, mighty father. He becomes Abraham, father of many nations, as time goes by. But Abraham responds. And I mentioned last time that Abraham was not a Bedouin to begin with. He was a member of a very highly sophisticated culture, Ur of the Chaldees, one of the great civilizations in the ancient world, one of the great cities in the ancient world. Archaeological excavation has uncovered all kinds of interesting things in that city. Gold jewelry that the people used, two-story houses that they had, very well-built houses. It was an extremely high culture. So Abram was used to all of that. And he left it all. And to him, going out into the middle of nowhere in a tent was just as strange as it would be to you. You're used to living in a house, not a tent. And to go out and leave all these comforts of a high civilization and go out in the middle of nowhere where none of these conveniences were available took some degree of dedication. It was not that Abram was just a poor semi-civilized individual who found it quite congenial to live in a tent. No, he gave up much to do that. He was called to do that, and he turned his back on a very high culture to walk a pathway that was a very difficult pathway. Now, to me, the heartwarming thing about Abram is that obedience. There was never any question in the life of Abraham who was calling the shots. When God called him, so Abram departed. He obeyed at once, implicit, immediate obedience to whatever the Lord wanted. Now, this is one of the great characteristics about the pilgrimage that we're all on. The one who guides our steps is the Lord. We do not direct our pathway. He does. And that means for every one of us, we have to ask ourselves the question, when God calls, do we drag our feet? Do we multiply excuses for not doing what the Lord has asked us to do? When he has opened up the door and manifested the pathway, do we spring forward? Well, you say, you know, the pathway is hard. There are stumbling blocks to get over. Yes, there were many of them that Abram had to get over, but he responded at once. It was a privilege to obey. God was number one. Now, there is something that all of us as pilgrims must remember. We too must put God in that position. Not to the point that at some time we will obey. At some time we will get to the right pathway. No. Immediately, as Abram, to do it now. If this is God's will, do it. If he calls, respond. That's what God is watching for. It's that immediate, heartfelt desire to please him that makes the difference and makes a pilgrim pathway blessed. There are some Christians, from their outward appearance, that give every indication of going down the pathway with great reluctance. They're not merely dragging their steps. You wonder at times whether the Lord is dragging them along while they are kicking and screaming that they don't want to go. It's kind of an odd psychology. But the Lord looks for the willing heart. He wants to see the person who desires to respond, who desires to walk that pilgrim pathway, because that is the pathway of God. That is where the presence of God is. That is the goal that you're heading toward, his person. And when you spring forward to go on that pathway, you're telling him you're delighted to see him. You're pleased at the thought of traveling that pathway with him. That's exactly what we see with Abraham. Notice the blessing that comes. In verse 7, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "Unto thy seed will I give this land." And he builded an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence to a mountain on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed. Yes, it was a pilgrim pathway. He was traveling. He didn't know where. He didn't understand what he was going through, but he was determined to do it. He was traveling that pathway for God. He wanted to commune with God. The pathway was God's way, and he delighted at the thought of communing with God. My friends, that is always the pathway. You are called sometimes to very hard pathways. And you will find yourself wondering, why does this have to happen? Here we are wanting to serve the Lord. Why does this have to happen? To slow us down, to make it difficult. It's always the way it is. The spiritual pilgrimage is not a downhill saunter. The spiritual pathway that we are called to is an uphill climb. It is hard. There are obstacles. There are enemies. There are things in that pathway to intimidate anybody. That is God's choice. He could have made the pathway easier. He chose not to. He walks that pathway. And if we want fellowship with him, we must walk his chosen pathway, a hard uphill climb with all the difficulties and all the adversaries and the presence of God. This is divinely ordained. The pilgrim pathway is a rough road, but God is there. And when you travel it, there is no obstacle that He cannot help you past. There is no adversary that He cannot defeat. There is no problem that you face that He is not the answer to it. He is there to provide everything you need, and the path is rough enough that you need Him every hour. That is why the difficulties are there. They're not there just because God has forgotten about you. They're not there just because God delights in making the way hard. He delights in moving the believer to Himself. And let's face it, if the pathway were easy, we would forget Him. We would go our way, have our fun, and sooner or later, we'd find the pathway. No, it's a hard pathway, and we need Him now. We need His grace now. And so it is, a pilgrim pathway with God. In verse 10, there was famine in the land. The pathway is hard. It always is. The human resources that we rely upon disappear. Famine in the land. Civilization breaks down. The things we trust in are gone. Now, plainly, we're living in a time of transition where the old traditions of our society and our government are deteriorating and disappearing. Now, what are you going to do in the midst of change? You're going to become a weathercock spinning about with every breath of wind as it shifts? Or are you on a pathway that travels that way regardless of what everything else is doing? You see, the pilgrimage gives you the direction. When the change comes about, yes, it tells you once again, you can't bank on man. The arm of flesh will fail you. You cannot depend on things as they always have been. They're not that way anymore. Everything is different except God. He is the same. He always will be the same. His pathway is the same. You can travel it with confidence. It is not going to change. It is His will. It will be His will to the day you die and you go home to face Him directly. There's the comfort. I think sometimes Christians think that the pathway ought to be easy. After all, we have finally obeyed God. We are going in the right direction. Surely He ought to kind of grease the ways for us a little bit. It doesn't work that way. It's rough. And it stays that way because we need Him. And we are continually reminded. In chapter 13, another of the hard things that Abram faced, family difficulties, the disputes between Lot and himself, starting out with their herdsmen, winding up face to face. And Lot, selfish, unconcerned about Abraham, and Abraham, generous to a fault, of bending over backwards to give his wayward nephew whatever he wanted. Let him take the choice first, and Abraham will take whatever's left. Well, that's rare, but we see that in Abraham. And it reminds us that some of the hardest parts of the pilgrimage have to do with family relationships. If you recall Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress once again, Christian went alone. His wife didn't go with him. And that was a great heartache to him, that his family was back there in the city of destruction and he couldn't get them to move. But he went. And as it happened, they were watching. And they got a testimony there that was overwhelming. And the time came when they too left the city and came after. Don't miss that point. Sometimes in the family, the deepest sorrows of the pilgrimage are found. And at the same time in the family, the greatest joys of the pilgrimage can be found. But they are there, mixed up together, the joys and the sorrows. That is life on the pilgrim pathway. In verse 18, after this resolution of the dispute, it says that Abram removed his tent and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. So he changed his location again, this time to humor his nephew, Lot. And the first thing he did was provide for the worship of God. Now that ought to be first in our lives. Whatever we are thinking of, we ought to think of him first. Sometimes a student will come to me for advice as an advisor, and he will say, now I'm getting to the end of my career, going to graduate, and got a good opening. The place has opened up and turns out to be a fine job, fine salary, and so on. And I'll be going up there and interviewing for it in just a little bit. Looks like it's going to be just God's will. I always ask, what church is in the area? It's a surprising number of them to look very blankly at you. Oh? Well, I don't know what's in the area. Now, it looks like that would be one of the things that would be considered first. The money, the salary that a certain job pays does not really give you a good indication of God's will. It may be profitable, but that's really not the point. If that is God's will for you, then there's some kind of a spiritual reason that you should be in that area, and that's usually because there's some local church there that you ought to be in. And for some students, they look so blankly at you. Well, I never thought of that. Well, how about looking for a church when you're up there, not just looking for a job interview? It's a new idea. That shouldn't be a new idea to anybody. For all of us, we should have in our minds, the first thing is the spiritual relationship. The first thing is pleasing God, walking the pathway in a way that would satisfy him. And oh yes, we also have to have material needs met. There's got to be a salary to pay the debts and all that. Sure. But God must come first. For Abram, God was first. Wherever he went, he built an altar. He worshiped God first. And also he lived in Mamre and Hebron and so on, but he worshiped God first. In chapter 15, God renewed his promises to Abram. The word of the Lord came to Abram, saying, "Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward." God didn't miss Abraham's attitude. God knew exactly what Abram was doing. Abraham was systematically putting God first. God knew it. And God pronounces a special benediction on Abraham. From a human standpoint, it looked like he was coming out the loser. Lot was getting the best territory. The Philistines and others around him were getting advantages of him. Abraham was just serving God, that's all. And God says, "I am thy great reward." And Abram has a request. "Lord God, what wilt thou give me, seeing I go childless?" Here was the great grief of Abraham and Sarah, no child. To the Jews, this was a major tragedy. For the line to die out this way, this was, well, for some it would be considered the judgment of God. Most horrible way for the life to end. And so Abram asks, and the Lord promises him. Verse 5, he brings him forth abroad at night, and says, "Look now toward heaven. Tell the stars, if thou be able to number them, so shall thy seed be." And he believed in the Lord, and he counted it to him for righteousness. Here's that serene faith of Abraham. All those spangled stars overhead. And we don't know what that sight looked like. Unless you've been on a mountaintop or on a boat at sea, you haven't seen that view. You look up at the night sky in this country and you see just a few stars. The smog and the haze just blinds you. But when you're way out away from civilization, on a mountain peak or out at sea at night, and you look up at the night sky, you are astonished at how many stars are visible out there. And that's what Abraham looked at, and he believed God could do it. Now, the surprising thing about that is that God counted that to him for righteousness. Now, technically, that's not a salvation promise. It's a salvation for multiple progeny, great material blessing. But Abram believed the word of the Lord, and God credited to him for righteousness. You don't have to believe a so-called salvation verse to get saved. What you have to do is submit to God's revelation, whatever that is. Abraham submitted. It was credited to his account. Now that's how anybody is saved. That's why some people are saved from rather odd verses. It was the verse on which they surrendered, not just the particular salvation verse that was important. It was the verse on which they trusted God. That's what it takes. On the pilgrim pathway, you must trust. You walk by faith, not by sight. And as you believe, the pathway unfolds before you. And for Abraham, yes, he believed. We must believe. Romans chapter 4. Paul urges that these things are not written just so that we can understand about Abraham. These things are written so that we will believe that way. And that may be imputed to us, just as it was to Abraham. Yes, Paul is thinking of us all there, not just simply of an Old Testament patriarch. It's interesting that in verse 9, the Lord says to Abraham to divide the animals, the heifer, the goat, the ram. And in verse 10, he divided the carcasses and laid each piece one against another. The birds he put one on each side. When the fowls, the vultures, came down, Abram drove them away. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. Lo, a horror of great darkness fell upon him. And he said to Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge. And afterward shall they come out with great substance. But thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. In the same day the Lord literally cut a covenant with Abram, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. Here is the pictorial confirmation of the covenant that Abram makes with God. God is the one who gives the terms. Abram can either accept them or refuse them. He can't modify them at all. And God gives him exactly what his will is. And he has Abram take these carcasses and divide them in two. Now, if this were a human agreement, say between Abraham and King Abimelech or one of the others that he knew, the two of them would get together over that very scene with the divided carcasses, and the two would join hands, and they would walk down between those carcasses, a symbolic action in which the two of them are pledging that if they violate that covenant, may they be divided even as these carcasses are. A very solemn asseveration of an oath, of a covenant. But in this case, Abram isn't allowed to do that. This is not an equal covenant. This is the Lord's covenant. And what happens? Abram sees the Lord like a great burning lamp, like a fire, a furnace, pass between those animals. God is saying, If I fail to keep this covenant, may I be dismembered like these carcasses. God has given his word. It will be kept. And Abram sees, but he is not permitted to walk that pathway. Only God can do that. And Abram accepts what God has done. Ultimately, that's exactly how all of us must face it. We can't change the terms of God's covenant. You don't tell God what the terms of salvation are. You receive them. He tells you in the Scripture, this is what he expects. This is what his will is. We are in the position of receiving it. And so we are saved by grace, through faith, and we walk a pilgrim pathway. Now, God tested Abram. In Genesis 22, one of the hard tests, because God singles out of Abram's life that item that he was most fond of, Isaac. Of everything that Abram had, Isaac was it. The child of his old age, his heart obviously doted upon this child. Everything else he could give without blinking. Abraham was not a materialist. The goods and the cattle he had meant nothing. Isaac was it. And the Lord comes and asks him to take his son, thine only son, Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. Here is the sacrifice of yourself. And that is an integral part of the pilgrim pathway. The question keeps coming up again and again. Will I do what I want? Will I arrange things for my benefit? Will I come out ahead on all this? And the biblical answer is, God must come out ahead. God's will must be done, whether you come out ahead or not. That's the biblical answer. And every so often the Lord puts his finger on a sore spot and says, how about this? Does this belong to me or to you? That's what he does here. And in this case, Abram gives a tremendous answer. Isaac belonged to the Lord. Abraham gave him to the Lord. And undoubtedly, he felt just as profoundly about this as any of you parents would, being asked to sacrifice a child. He gives him to the Lord. And there's no hanging back. He puts him on the altar. He takes the knife in hand. And the angel cries out, Abraham, Abraham, and stops him in mid-stroke. And the comment is most suggestive in verse 12. Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. Well, now God is omniscient. He knows everything. Was this a surprise to God? Now, there's a difference between theoretical knowledge and practical knowledge. From a theoretical standpoint, yes, Abraham believed God, just as we do. Abram was traveling the pilgrim pathway just as we are supposed to. There's a second question. When the chips are down and the test is there, what kind of a choice is Abraham going to make? There's no question what he made. Isaac belonged to God. And God says, now I know. It is not theory, it's practice. He did it. Now that's exactly what he's looking for in us. Is it all theory with us? Is it all just imagination? Or is it a definite, settled choice that God is supreme and God owns our children and our house and everything else we've got? He owns all our relationships, all our pleasures. God owns it all. If he asks for it, it's his. Or is it just theory? We've got piles of Christians today sitting in churches in this country right now, where really God does not own anything. They own it. And they call the shots. That is not a pilgrimage. Now, let us look at Jacob. In Genesis 25, Jacob starts out poorly. When you consider an unlikely choice, it'd have to be Jacob. In verse 33, Jacob outfoxes his brother and steals his inheritance, which is hardly a good way to begin. In a few more chapters, he outfoxes his father and steals the blessing from him in chapter 27. And here again is a man with religious aspirations and no ethics. He desires good things, and he's willing to steal and cheat and lie and deceive in order to get them, which is odd. But in chapter 28, he meets God. He is traveling, fleeing, in effect, from the results of one of his rather unethical deeds. and he stops at Bethel. Well, it's not called Bethel at that time, but he stops at this place and sees the ladder. And my friends, Jacob had been acting as though there were no connection between this realm and that realm, which is the way a lot of Christians live. I'm doing my own thing down here, so who knows? They cut the corners here, well, who will ever tell? And they don't see the connection between the realms. But here Jacob looks and he sees heaven and earth joined with this ladder. And all of a sudden, what he has been doing has immediate connection with God. He has deceived no one. God knows. And this place is the house of God. But it was just a place on the pathway. But it's a place where he met God. And that is the blessing of the pilgrim pathway. That pathway is the place where you meet God. It's a place where you discover the connection between his realm and this realm. It is the place where you discover God rules up there. And that's why we have to live the way we live here. The two are connected. And Jacob begins a rather checkered career. And oh, there are problems and trials. And I won't go through the details of his life. You know that, I'm sure. But let me note to you, in chapter 31 and verse 13, the Lord appears to Jacob again and says to him, I am the God of Bethel, where thou anointedst a pillar, where thou vowedest a vow unto me. Now arise, get thee out from this land, return to the land of thy kindred. Summoning him back to Bethel, back to the house of God. Yes, Jacob had to leave the doubtful practices, the maneuvering with Laban that had been going on for lo those many years. He had to come back to the house of God. Back to the place where he met God. The pilgrimage is God's pathway, and we have to keep coming back to the presence of God. And Jacob did. In chapter 35, God said to Jacob, Arise, go up to Bethel, dwell there, make there an altar unto God that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother. And Jacob said to his household and to all with him, Put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments. Let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God. Now this tells us things were not altogether well with Jacob's family. There were those there that weren't worshiping God the way they should. And here he summons them back to Bethel. Let's get serious about what we're doing. It's very evident for all pilgrims that this is the vital element of the pathway. Are you serious about what you are doing? Or is this just a saunter? Are you really on a pilgrim pathway in which you are traveling from the city of destruction to Mount Zion? Are you really traveling and seeing landmarks pass by, seeing new vistas that bring you closer to a destination? Is the place you're dwelling now the house of God? Or is it something else? For Jacob, he had to learn the hard way. He made all the wrong choices. He did the things that God had to judge him for. But he did learn. He finally did find the pathway. He did travel it. And he was changed from Jacob, the supplanter, to Israel, a prince with God. Now that's grace. When you look at the way Jacob began, no one would ever guess he would wind up a prince with God. But he did. If we may return to Genesis 47. In verse 7, Joseph brings Jacob in now before Pharaoh. And here 130 years of the pilgrim pathway has gone down the road. It's been a struggle, mixed with joy and mixed with sorrow. He had the sorrow of seeing his son Joseph sold into Egypt. The brothers bring the bloody cloak. What sorrow he had about that. But the joy of finding that Joseph was in Egypt and safe. Beyond that, a great ruler in the land. What a surprise. A checkered path. But it turned out to be God's path. And Jacob walked it. It was feeble at first. It was tottering at first. But he walked it. And 130 years now, he stands before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh looks at him, obviously a very old man. And in tones of awe, he says, "How old art thou?" The answer is 130 years. But Jacob adds, "Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been." Few? 130 years? Who among us expect 130 years, eh? Now, Jacob wasn't satisfied with 130 years. Jacob wanted eternity with God. Jacob had walked with God. Jacob had found the house of God. He didn't want to leave. 130 years were nothing. He wanted eternity with God. He would not be satisfied with anything less. And so must we. Few and evil. Yes, he faced the sin. He recognized what was wrong. Obviously, he changed. And now he's in a position not merely where he can be a blessing to his children, as he is, but a blessing to a king. The grace of God is amazing. When you look at Jacob early in his life, you'd think he would never be a blessing to anybody. But before God was through, he would. It was the pathway that did it. That hard pathway. That pathway of seeing Rachel buried. That pathway of seeing Joseph gone. That pathway of over and over again apparent failure. But no, Jacob won, largely because he lost. God won. And Jacob identified himself with God and conquered. The pilgrim pathway that God has called you to is hard. I'll tell you that right away at the beginning. It is not a soft passage. It is a rough pathway. It is rough so that you will seek God's help. And when you do, it turns out that nothing can stop you. There is not a single event on that pathway that can turn you aside. God is there. You are traveling to His presence in glory. If you let Him empower your steps and stay on that pathway, the day will come when you will see Him face to face, and all the trials will be over, and the joy will be endless, and the fellowship will be there. To think of being a blessing to others, to think of being useful to God, Jacob attained to that. It was a pathway that was God's way, and he walked it. What kind of pathway are you on? Every head bowed, every eye closed. In this quiet moment, God's Spirit has spoken to your heart. Maybe you have been traveling an irregular pathway. Maybe you've been running down the pathway with God for a little bit and then running off in another direction. And the Lord's Spirit says, "Will you take the pathway permanently? Will you walk it from now on? Humbly, faithfully, never turning back."